You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Our words of wisdom are from 1 Kings chapter 19, verses 4 through 9.
When Elijah saw how things were, he ran for dear life to Beersheba, far in the south of Judah. He left his young servant there and then went on into the desert another day's journey. He came to a lone broom bush and collapsed in its shade, wanting in the worst way to be done with it all, to just die.
Enough of this, God. Take my life. I'm ready to join my ancestors in the grave.
Exhausted, he fell asleep under the lone broom bush. Suddenly, an angel shook him awake and said,
"Get up and eat."
He looked around and, to his surprise, right by his head were a loaf of bread baked on some coals and a jug of water. He ate the meal and went back to sleep. The angel of God came back, shook him awake, and said,
"Get up and eat some more. You've got a long journey ahead of you."
He got up, ate, and drank his fill, and set out. Nourished by that meal, he walked 40 days and nights all the way to the mountain of God, to Horeb. When he got there, he crawled into a cave and went to sleep. Then the word of God came to him.
"So, Elijah, what are you doing here?"
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
I want to thank Pastor David and the Fountains for inviting me back to preach for the studio, but also to preach in person on Sunday at the Fountains. I've chosen a text from the lectionary that focuses on one of my favorite people of the Hebrew scripture, the Old Testament, and that is the prophet Elijah. He lives in the northern kingdom, and the northern kingdom of Israel, it was formed by the 10 tribes that broke off after the death of Solomon. Remember, two tribes remain loyal in Jerusalem, called the Kingdom of Judah. 10 tribes are in the north with their capital in Samaria. Now, I need to let you know that the Kingdom of Israel was a hotbed of craziness, if you will, to put it lightly. The reason why is because it was this region that was surrounded by great powers: Syria, eventually Babylon and Assyria, the Hittites, the Canaanites, the Phoenicians. All these people surrounded the Kingdom of Israel, and so it was always on the edge, if you will, of political survival. And in order to survive, the kings of Israel, well, like many monarchies throughout history, had to intermarry with some of the daughters from the surrounding kingdoms. And so one king, Omri, decides that his son Ahab is going to marry the daughter of their enemy, the king of Syria, one of my favorite women of the Old Testament, Jezebel. And so Ahab marries Jezebel. Now, we don't know too much about how all of that, you know, how political marriages work. They probably didn't know one another. They probably didn't see each other until the day of their wedding, so to speak. But in any event, that Ahab now, when he becomes king, tries to secure his throne. And he does this by now having an alliance through his wife Jezebel with the king of Syria. It's meant for him, right? He's the boss. He's the one. He's the focus, right? Well, Jezebel says, "You know, honey, Ahab, I'm not just going to come myself. I mean, I've got this whole retinue of people that are going to come with me. And I'm going to bring some of my furniture and, you know, all of that kind of stuff." Probably it was 3 miles long, the caravan, to bring all of Jezebel's stuff down to the capital in Samaria, which means that Ahab has to enlarge the palace. You know how that goes. Families enlarge. Well, you don't just have your wife. You've got all of her ladies-in-waiting, all of their families, and so forth, right? Well, you know, what Ahab is very concerned about making sure that Jezebel's happy because she comes in to a foreign place. Well, Jezebel's not dumb. She's very, very smart. She knows how these political alliances work. So she goes to Ahab one day and she says, "Honey, you know, when I was back home in Syria, I didn't worship your God, Yahweh. I worshiped my God, Baal. Do you think we could build a little room in the palace so that I could worship Baal? You know, I'll go to the temple with you to worship your God, Yahweh, but I'm going to worship Baal. Well, you know, again, you know how this goes. It doesn't just be one room. Pretty soon, Jezebel is demanding that a full-scale temple be built next to the temple of Yahweh in Samaria, so that now you see there's a choice. You either choose Yahweh or you're going to choose Baal. This is going to be a part of what's the contest that Elijah will have later on in the story in the first book of Kings. Well, Ahab sees economic advantages in this, not only political advantages, but economic advantages, social advantages, because a king who has a massive retinue of royal people, not just to support, that's why he needs the economics to support such a massive household, but it means that, you know, when push comes to shove, those people are going to support you against any enemies that you may have. So what happens is, and now see, this is a part of the religious tradition that goes further back, that it's expected that if you're going to have Yahweh as the chief God, the only God in your kingdom, that all of the political, economic, social, religious structures are to reflect that honoring of Yahweh. Well, once Jezebel brings in Baal, now, you know, who's ever going to have the loudest voice to the ear of the king is going to get their way, and pretty soon the worship of Yahweh begins to decline, and it's lost in much of the kingdom of Israel. Needless to say, God's not happy about this. Yahweh's not happy about this. So Yahweh sends Elijah, chooses Elijah to go to Ahab and to issue a complaint. You know, you come from this long line of tradition going all the way back to Moses and the slaves in Egypt through Saul and David and Solomon and Omri and so forth. You must worship Yahweh. You cannot have any other gods. That's what the commands say. You shall have no other gods before me. Ahab sees Jezebel over his shoulder, scowling at this whole proposition that the worship of Baal will be limited only to her private chapel in the palace. Ahab says, you know, happy wife, happy life. There's no way that I'm going to go against my wife Jezebel. Sorry, Ahab, I cannot do that. Through Elijah, God says, fine, there's going to be a drought. Now, you need to know that this whole region of Israel is one of the richest agricultural regions in the whole of the Middle East. Just incredible. It's mountainous, it's green, it's lush, and so forth. And so to have a drought, you can imagine, my garden's dead out here, that even if I've watered it three times a day with the heat the way it's been, it's dead. So you can imagine to go without water when, and this area is not too far off. It's almost like Florida, where there's heat and humidity. And so if you don't have the rain, nothing's going to grow. Well, that is just disastrous for Ahab, that if the economy is not going to work, and there's no crops to come in, and the people aren't going to be happy, and I don't care how much Jezebel's scowling in the background, that this isn't going to work out good. But Ahab says, I got Jezebel to be thinking about over here? No. And so a drought happens, reaches the breaking point. Finally, in an encounter between Ahab and Elijah, I love this line. This is one of my favorite. That when they meet, Ahab sees Elijah coming and he says, is that you, you troubler of Israel? You're the one who's caused all these problems. I got Jezebel on my back. I've got the people ready to throw me out of power. I've got my enemies laughing because I'm so looking so weak. You're the troubler. And Elijah says back to Ahab, excuse me, you're the one who's introduced the cult of Baal. You're the one who's causing the problems, not me. So Elijah says, okay, how about this, Ahab? We'll go to Mount Carmel, and there we'll set up a contest. Your prophets and priests representing Baal will come, and I will come, and whoever wins this contest, whoever has the sacrifice consumed in flames, that will be the winner, and that will be the God of Israel. Ahab says, piece of cake, I got this. My prophets and priests are much stronger and more numerous than you, Elijah, who's just one person. They get to Mount Carmel, beautiful, I've been there, incredible. You can see all the surrounding, the Mediterranean Sea on one side, the Esdraelon Valley on the other side, just an incredibly beautiful area, the mountain. Elijah says, okay, here's the contest. You prophets of Baal, you go first. I'm very kind and generous. You go first. The prophets of Baal wreck their sacrifice. They get out and nothing happens. Elijah standing on the side, he goes, you know, I think your God must be taking a siesta. So maybe if you dance louder and make more noise, you'll wake him up and maybe your God then will respond. So they go, oh, okay. They get out and they just chant louder and they dance more furiously around the altar of sacrifice and nothing happens. They're exhausted. They pass out. Elijah steps forward and says, okay, my turn. We'll see now who God, the God of Israel, is going to be. But Elijah makes it tougher. He says, put water on the sacrifice. Not enough. Put more water. Put more water. Sop and wet. The prophets of Baal and the priests of Baal are just laughing. How can you possibly think that anything is going to consume that sacrifice with all that water on it? Elijah steps back and says, in contemporary language, if you pardon the expression, okay, God, Yahweh, you're on. And a great ball of fire comes down and consumes the sacrifice. Elijah says, that's it. Only Yahweh can be God in Israel. Now, at the end of that story is one of the more troubling parts of the Hebrew scripture. It says that Elijah takes the priest, the prophet of Baal, down to the Wadi Kishon and slits their throats. Imagine your whole religious intelligentsia, your whole religious hierarchy is wiped out. Guess what? Doesn't make Jezebel very happy at all. She's furious. She storms into the royal chamber and says, you got to do something about that, Elijah. Ahab sends out the armies, the hounds of Ahab. Elijah flees for his life, and that's where our text this Sunday starts. He's running for his life. He knows that if the armies of Ahab catch up with him, he's gone. He's done for. He'll be killed on the spot. He runs for his life. He flees out into the wilderness. And one of his servants, the text said, right? Servant, he says, stay here and I'm going to go further. And he goes out into the desert. And of all things, he takes a nap. He sits down under a broom tree and takes a nap. Oh my gosh, you're running for your life. The hounds of Ahab are after you. You just won the greatest contest of your life and you got time to sit down and take a nap? An angel of God comes along and slaps him up the side of the face and says, Elijah, what are you doing here? Here, have some bread. You better eat because it's a long journey. Keep that in mind. It's a long journey. There's work to be done. Elijah eats the bread. You can imagine. Heat, bread. He's full of carbohydrates. You think he's going to be filled with energy to go out and fight the fight? No, he lays down and takes another nap, for God's sake. Oh my gosh, he takes another nap. The angel comes and slaps him up the side of the head and says, hey, buddy, you know, you got a job to do. You've got to confront Ahab and Jezebel, and you got to do something about this because that's your task as a prophet. You don't have time for naps. There's no more napping. Elijah gets up, and the last lines of the text today said, and he walks 40 days and 40 nights to the Mount Horeb. Now you see, we could just, wow, that's a long way, 40 days and 40 nights. You could be pretty far, right, on 40 days and 40 nights. But what you need to hear in this, you see, and whoever's hearing this text originally, it would be setting off bells in their heads. 40 days and 40 nights, let me see. 40 days and 40 nights. Remember the story of Noah? It rained for 40 days and 40 nights. Judgment placed upon humanity. 40 days. Oh, wait a minute. Remember the story of the Israelites? After they flee from slavery in Egypt, they wandered in the desert for 40 years. Oh, wow. And telescoping down into the New Testament times, after his baptism, Jesus goes out into the wilderness, 40 days and 40 nights. Wow. The symbolism of this is something's dramatic is about to happen. The text is alerting us to make those connections, that what Elijah has been trying to tell the people of Israel is that their long tradition of connection to God by way of the covenant is more important than any political alliances, any power politics, any economics based upon, you know, whoever can make the most money wins, that this covenant based in the vision of the commandments is what's most important. And how do I know that? Because where he's going to end up is Mount Horeb. Ever heard of that? I bet if you looked at it, you see, this is the northern people's designation for, wait for it, Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai and Mount Horeb are the same. Elijah ends up at Sinai, where the story of the people of Israel began. He ends up at the place, at the very place where that encounter between Moses and God was so intense that it transforms Moses. And you know what is at the heart of that encounter there at Sinai, right? The text in Exodus says, I have called you here to be my people, meaning there's a special mission that you have in the world. And the mission is one of holiness. In other words, you are to reflect me to the world. You are to show the world what being in relationship with the divine is all about. And this relationship is founded upon a set of relationships, of more relationships, that have to do with the way that you honor and respect the dignity of life, the earth, everything. I'm a little ahead of myself, but that's what it's about, remember? And it's not just about 10 commandments, laws. No. It's about a way of life. That's what Torah is about. You shall be to me a people of holiness. And the holiness means not of piety. Holiness has to do with reflecting the character, the nature, the reality of God to the world. Well, what's the reality of God to the world? What is it to look like? Well, it's obvious that Ahab and Jezebel have violated the first one. You shall have only one God, not multiple gods, not gods who will draw your attention away from the focus of this vision that I have established for you in a way of life I have called you to. But you are to have only one God. And this God defines everything about you. It defines your politics. It defines your economics. It defines your social realities. It defines how you live in the world, the choices and decisions. It defines your ethics. It defines your morality. It defines everything about you. That's the idea. That was the idea, right? And if you look through the history, that's the problem. They didn't get it. They didn't realize how serious God was. That when you're in relationship with God in this way, it defines every aspect of who you are. And so part of it is, right? Honor God. Keep the Sabbath, meaning the Sabbath is a revolutionary practice that you are not defined by your work, by your wealth, by your material goods. You're defined by this relationship of holiness with God. That's what defines you. That's what Sabbath is about. That you are to honor the dignity of your elders. That you can't just put them in a home and throw away the key and never visit them again. You are to honor your elders, the seniors in your midst. That you are to value life, and not just one part of life, all of life, every aspect of life. You cannot murder or kill. Got it? You are to value the dignity and the integrity of everyone's life. Because if we remember Genesis, everyone is created in the divine image and likeness. Straight, gay, trans, black, white, whatever. Everyone has dignity. And not just levels of dignity. Everyone has equal dignity. Everyone is equal in the sight of God. Got it? Everyone is equal in the sight of God. And the last part, the last actually seven of the commandments, is about how we're going to live in community with each other. The practice of neighborliness, as Walter Brueggemann called it. It's the practice of honoring and respecting the goods of people, the community. It's about a practice of neighborliness that describes how we're going to get along in society and how we're going to be community together. And so this contest that was set up between Baal and Yahweh, between Elijah and Ahab, is really a contest of which worldview is going to define who we are and what we're about. Will it be the worldview of Baal that doesn't value life, that sees that power politics has to do who can control and dominate and subjugate others? Is it a worldview in the way that Baal does it, is that there isn't any respect for the value, integrity, and dignity of life? In fact, one of the sacrifices later in the history will be that they're sacrificing children. They think they can appease God and keep God happy by sacrificing their own children on an altar. Imagine that. That this worldview of Baal has nothing to do with the value of life, with the dignity, the integrity. It has nothing to do with an economics built upon the practice of neighborliness. The worldview of Baal stands in stark contrast to the worldview of Yahweh, that sees that honoring life, the dignity of life, honoring the community that we live in, having a sense of our common connection in the practice of neighborliness. It's a stark contrast between the two worldviews. And so in that text, when God says, "What are you doing taking a nap?" that God is saying, you know, this is too big a job for you to sit it out. It's too big a job for you to take a nap and to say, "I'm not going to have anything. I'm tired of politics. I'm tired of fighting with the bank. I'm even tired of Jezebel," perhaps. God says, you can't do that. There's work to be done. You can't sit it out. You can't take time off. You can't go on vacation and say, "I don't want to have anything more to do with." It's too much at stake. That the contrast between the two worldviews, the prophet Baal and Yahweh, the contrast between these two worldviews are stark. It said in the book of Deuteronomy this, "I set before you today life, death." Want to choose death? Fine. Ain't going to get you very far. If you choose life, there's so much to be looked forward to. Such a great future. Elijah, there's still work to do. People of the fountains, there's still work to do. We can talk about being inclusive if we're not practicing it. But it's not enough just for us to practice it. That we are about the work of trying to invite, encourage, and invite others to join this vision. It's about getting out there and working hard to bring that sense of dignity and purpose and value of the earth, of people, to others. It's about helping them understand that the deathliness of what Baal represents is not the future that God intends for us. It is about the life and the livelihood and the peace, the shalom, the sacred shalom, the sacred relationship. It's about that. There's work to do, people. We don't have time to take a nap. There's still too much to accomplish, and we still got too much journey to take.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputtlovefirst.org.